Let's do it.
Excellent.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and this is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, television, theatre, in fact, just about anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and me lately.
And for our 45th podcast, a smorgasbord of the cinematic, including director Steven Soderbergh's latest crime caper, Logan Lucky.
Al Gore resumes his battle to win over our hearts and minds on climate change, this time in an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power.
Now, you've seen it before, but not quite like this. James Cameron has reissued Terminator 2 Judgment Day, but this time in 3D. Now, the original was a cracker in its day, it really was. So, has it held up? And how much better is it with the 3D glasses on?
Wonderful question. Now, first came the novels, then the graphic novels, and now the movie. Stephen King's fantasy epic The Dark Tower has just arrived. The question is, should they have bothered?
And just when you thought we'd actually managed to go a complete week without mentioning superheroes, well, this time we're on the small screen, but Marvel are at it again. It's The Defenders this time, and it's just arrived on Netflix.
Righto, let's start, though, with American director Steven Soderbergh's latest. It's called Logan Lucky. And, Steve, this is a heist movie, would be fair to say, but when you say that, I guess for a lot of people, they'll automatically think about those Ocean's 11, 12, 13 movies that Soderbergh did a few years back. But this one, isn't it? I mean, it's certainly clever and it's certainly comedic, but its setting, it's far removed from those flash conmen like Brad Pitt and George Clooney that we saw in those flashy casinos and those Ocean's films, isn't it?
It is, and yet it shares a certain style and a certain panache and an intricate plotting with those films. In fact, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say at one point it's the heist is referred to by one character as Ocean 7-Eleven, which does actually sum it up quite nicely. Basically, it's Ocean's 11 transplanted to the deep south. So we've still got the same sort of verve and absurdity, but it's got a seriously redneck tinge, hasn't it?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Yeah, so you're right. It's the southern sort of working class America milieu, isn't it, Steve? And in this, just very quickly talk about the plot. You've got mine worker Jimmy Logan, and he's played by Channing Tatum. He's just been laid off from a job at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. So he needs some money. He hatches a plan to rob the Speedway of cash, cold hard cash, on a race day. He gets his brother, Clyde, played by Adam Driver, and also his sister, Mally, played by Riley Keough. I think that's how you say her name. But he actually needs even more help than that. And this is where the wonderfully named Bang Brothers come in.
I know, they're fantastic, aren't they? We've got the eldest Bang brother, Joe Bang, played rather bizarrely, but reasonably well, to be fair, by Daniel Craig, who is having a fantastic time. You can tell,
isn't he? Yes.
You can tell he's not being James Bond, and he's enjoying the break. He's having a great time, and he's a bomb expert. You know, obviously with a name like Joe Bang, what else would he be? and he's rather inconveniently still in prison for a previous bang. But the younger brother is Sam. You got Sam played by Brian Gleeson. You got Fish played by Jack Quaid are also brought in on the act, and. While they are very much thumbnail characters, they are fleshed out surprisingly pleasingly well.
Yeah, I agree.
And with a great supporting cast, we've got Hilary Swank, you know, we've got Catherine Waterston, Katie Holmes, Seth MacFarlane, the highly questionable Seth MacFarlane, and so there's a lot sort of going on as you'd expect in an Oceans-ish. It was like Creek 11, really, I suppose, more than anything else.
Oh, well said. Well
I know.
Said,
I've been working for. I knew there was a pithy line in there somewhere. It finally came to me. So, did it work?
I think it did. I have to say, I enjoyed it a lot. Immensely, I'd even say. It's a lot of fun. And while this isn't a new genre of movie to get into, obviously, I thought overall this is a pretty classy effort, Steve. I thought it was well written and directed. There were some genuinely funny lines and scenes. I thought the actors seem to be having a not just Daniel Craig, but they all seem to be having a jolly good time. And it was a rollicking hour and a half or whatever it was. It zoomed along really nicely and nicely paced. I enjoyed it. You? What about you?
I thought it was superb. I mean, we've seen this film before in different settings. And so I think transplanting it to the Deep South was a risky move, But what hit me was the detail that they brought to it.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, things like, for example, Melly's fringed white leather cowboy boots, little details like that, you know, the sticking plaster with the My Little Pony on it. It's just the attention to detail in this film is what makes it, I think. It's played very, very well. We've got, you know, we've got pet cockroaches. It's incredible.
It's got that sort of, that quirkiness, doesn't it? That sort of slightly oddball aspect to it, the way it's played. And I agree with you about the detail. You really, Soderbergh really puts us in that southern environment, doesn't it? So I thought the even the color palette in the film felt sort of yellowish and tannish, sort of the brown dirt of the south or something. It just, it had that feel and look about it. It was, and some quite odd little cultural references that thrown in here and there that just made it zing along, I thought. I don't want to spoil it too much, but there's a reference to a rather popular Netflix series ongoing at the moment, which is rather delightfully done.
This is quite, I know the riff you're talking about is quite extensively played, and it's hilarious. It's very, very, very entertaining. Like I say, Daniel Craig's having the time of his life in this film. His southern accent, and I mean, why cast Daniel Craig in that role is beyond me.
Yeah, I know. But, yeah, it's interesting, yeah.
I mean, he can't need the money that badly, surely.
No, I just think he wanted to have a good time, I reckon.
Well, he certainly had one, didn't he? He had a great time.
Yeah.
And his southern accent, let's say a high merit, low excellence, it holds up pretty well.
Yes, I think, I agree with that. Not absolutely superb, but still pretty, you know, certainly it fitted the film absolutely fine.
And I am not...
Go ahead. Okay, I was going to say, Steve, I did have one little question. This is about... I'm not going to give it away, but we say this is kind of a heist movie, so there is a plan that is hatched and put into action as we follow the film along. And I just had this little question, and this might be me reacting to a stereotype, but the people here are presented basically as, you know, southern working class people.
Yes.
They're quite cunning, they're quite sly, but they also, the way they present on screen is at times rather simple people. I don't mean that in a derogatory way, I just mean they don't appear to be particularly, oh, that sounds like a derogatory comment, I don't mean it to be, but that's the way they're presented on screen. And at some point, as we start to see how this plan works, I thought, are these people, as we are being shown them, actually... Oh, this is a terrible thing to say, smart enough to hatch this plan. Did that thought occur to you at all?
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about, because this plays into the stereotype of the Southerners as uneducated hicks.
Yep.
And oddly enough, I'm very sensitive to this, because in England we have the exact geographic inversion of that, where the Northerners are perceived as being the thick ones. And yes, you're right, that they're at once depicted as being uneducated, slow hillbillies, and yet at the same time, they are concocting a contrived, intricately managed plan, which they then execute with great precision.
Yes.
I think they pull it off. I really do. I think part of the charm is watching the superficially thick as two short planks.
Yes, yes.
But in reality, sharp as a tack individuals pulling off a wonderful plan. And part of it is, you know, you mentioned Adam Driver as Clyde Logan. I know it's somewhat unfashionable. I am not an Adam Driver fan.
Uh-huh.
I don't rate him very highly at all. In particular, in the last Star Wars film, where he was basically emo Darth Vader, I thought he was rubbish.
Okay.
I think he tends to be sort of one-dimensionally glum. And yet somehow he found depth in Clyde Logan's character.
I enjoyed it. Yeah. He had, there was a certain deadpan aspect to the way he delivered it, but it was actually, you could sense there was a lot going on in the way behind the eyes, if you like. I enjoyed his performance.
Most of his characters are that quite literally one note. He speaks very flat, deadpan voice, but somehow he really made it work in this one.
Yeah.
Like you say, he found depth in it. There's something behind the eyes that's going on that's not usually in his characters. He's finally found where he can make that shtick work, and I really liked him in this.
Yeah, and just to finish up on your point about the cultural stereotype, I mean, I think maybe that was a wonderful point that Soderbergh was making in this film, that we can, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. And it's a well-tried theme to play. But I think it worked very, very well. And it made it actually more entertaining in a way. You felt yourself really kind of rooting for the underdog, if you will, all the more.
Does, I think you make a good point there, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I have absolutely no hesitation in saying I would buy a ticket to this and recommend anyone else to buy a ticket for it.
Most assuredly. Fantastic fun. I would consider seeing it again. I really, really enjoyed it.
Great. It's a really nice humour too. Okay, that is Logan Lucky. And let's, Steve, move from a really, really well-crafted piece of, I guess, escapist entertainment to something you've seen, which, by crikey, this is really more serious. This is Al Gore's follow-up to that 2006 documentary on climate change. Now, that was called An Inconvenient Truth, and this one is an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power. Now, Steve, I haven't seen it. You have. What did you make of it?
Well, Al's put the band back together. And
is he? Yeah.
And it's a very, very, very difficult film to review, this one, because on the one hand, it needed making. It's a very important film, just like An Inconvenient Truth was. It's a very important and very necessary film. He sent up a warning flare, what was it, about 10 years ago, and this is a reminder that things are actually still getting worse and we still need to listen to it. And so it's a very, very important film. However, yeah, while the original film was essentially the film of the PowerPoint presentation and yes, was a film of science, it was a documentary of science, the sequel is more a film about what Al Gore's doing about the science. And when they focused on the science, and also, to be fair, they also focused a lot on the politics of what Gore is doing. You know, you see him phoning up a vice president of the World Bank, or he whips out his phone and calls up one of Elon Musk's colleagues and just says, hey, it's Al Gore here. Here's what I want you to do, in a way that, you know, you and I might care equally as passionately about the climate as he does. We could never do that.
No, okay.
I phone up the head of the World Bank and say, hey, it's Steve here. And he's going, oh, that's nice, and hang up on me. So obviously it's very important they have a character like Al Gore, but when the film then becomes about him, then it fails, in my opinion. And for all the importance of showing us that glaciers are melting, we don't need to see Al Gore standing on a glacier to understand that. And we certainly don't need a tour of the Gore family farm in Tennessee to tell us about how important he is to the cause.
The only thing I just thought crossed my mind when you talked about him ringing up the guy from the World Bank is there any sense in which there's a message here that, you know, a guy who's as well known as he is and as well connected as he is, who is trying to battle away on this front and isn't, I suppose, you know, climate change is still a huge issue. Yes, the war is by no means won. I mean, if he's struggling, does that show, in a way, just how important it is for everyone to chime in and get behind him? Is that part of them? Is that a subliminal message? You know, one guy, even as clever as he is, can't do it alone. Or am I being a bit too kind to him there?
No. That is a very fair reading, because it does spend quite a while focusing on the environmental conference in Paris that led to the Paris Accords, which they do reference Donald Trump's withdrawal from. And obviously, it's very, very important that he shows that this is such an enormous deal that it's managed to marshal the entire world very nearly. And you've got people like Putin and, oh, what's his name, the Chinese leader, Xi Jinping. You've got all these people coming together with, it was Hollande was the French leader at the time. You've got Obama was there. You've got all these people who are pulling together. And so, yeah, it does show that you've got significant players in it. But then when you start seeing photographs of Gore's father with Lyndon B. Johnson hanging on the wall in his family home, you're thinking that's more self-indulgent.
Yes, that, yeah, it does sound like it, yeah.
And he does reference on several occasions his loss to George W. Bush in 2000.
Does he? Okay.
And you kind of get there's a subtext of, you know what, folks, if you'd elected me, I'd have been doing something about this by now. And there's a little bit of that. You know,
so oh, dear. No, that's a bit
Yeah. He manages not to come off sounding bitter about it. He manages to play it as, well, it's a good job I didn't get elected because now I can invest all my time in this. And that's how he kind of spins it. And he manages not to wallow. But yes. It does get a little bit hagiographical in places. And in particular, he references... Because during the Paris Accords, there was some terrible terrorist atrocities in Paris during the time that he was there for the Paris Climate Conference. And... It almost hints toward a suggestion. It gets dangerously close to suggesting that the Paris shootings were about him. It sort of hints toward that in a way that made me a little bit queasy. But then he manages to pull back for it and focus on the fact that he is doing something very, very, very important. And so there's one very, very telling scene where he's speaking to the Indian energy minister, who says to him, "Look, you want us to pull back on using fossil fuels. Fine, we'll do that after we've had 150 years of using them to develop our economy like you did." which is an extraordinarily reasonable point, but then Gore gets to get his nice little trump card of, yes, but the clouds will still be smoggy in the sky regardless of what you say. And he gets his nice little trump card, which is a nice little platitude, but it still doesn't address the issue. But then you then see the backroom negotiation of, well, what can we do to make it happen for you? Oh, you need better credit. We will get you better credit. We will make it happen. And so it becomes about his machinations. And while it's interesting, it moves away from the science and starts to becoming about, okay, here's why we're not making progress yet, and here's how we're going to make progress.
I guess the key question would be, is this the sort of – well, first of all, is this a film that someone who is not convinced of climate change would want to watch anyway? And if they did, would it convert them? Would it change their mind? I mean, it's obviously – there's a large body of people out there who are going to be converted already to his message. But those who are not, are they likely to be swayed by what they see in this film?
No, I don't see it winning over many skeptics. He doesn't spend an enormously long time focusing on the science of it, nowhere near as much as I would like to. I mean, he does, for example, show footage of Miami underwater, and he does the sort of the marquee thing that he points to is that in the original film he suggested that Manhattan would be flooded if there were ever a major hurricane, and everyone just laughed at him, and he pointed out that the 9/11 memorial in particular would be flooded, and everyone said, no, don't talk nonsense, and so he gets to show footage of those very things happening and saying, see, this is exactly what I was telling you about. But other than that, no, there's not a whole lot of actual science in it. Like I say, it's more about his dealings and his machinations, and so no, this will not win over any climate change skeptics. They're probably, let's face it, a lost cause right now anyway.
Yeah, okay. So I'm sort of getting a middling report card from you on this one, Steve, I think.
Well, as I say,
at best.
Yeah, it's not entertainment.
No.
It's not really going to win any converts in terms of actually persuading science and winning over skeptics. But at the same time, it's important.
Now, Steve, another film. Everyone knows about the famous American director James Cameron, who's actually spent a bit of time working in New Zealand. He is, among many other things, responsible for the two biggest earning movies of all time, Avatar and Titanic. I think they're one and two, and if you look in all these sort of movie websites about what's earned most money at the box office. Now, you might recall Avatar, when it first came out, it was released in 3D. And a few years after Titanic came out, he re-released that film in 3D. And now he's done it again with one of his very, very well-known films, and this is Terminator 2 Judgment Day, getting the 3D treatment. Now, Steve, I haven't seen this one. I certainly have seen the original film probably a few times, I reckon. And I remember seeing it the first time and thinking, this was genuinely exciting. The action was thrilling. And there were some genuinely scary moments in it too. I thought that I remember back to the first time seeing how the new Terminator, which was made of liquid metal that could sort of dissolve and move and merge with other objects, was quite well done and quite chilling. So you've seen it again in the 3D treatment. I guess the question is, A, how's it look a couple of decades later? And what difference does a 3D actually make?
Well, let's answer those questions in turn. First of all, it holds up. It really does. Everything you just said about it from 25 years ago, and that apparently is the significance here, it's the 25th anniversary reissue. Right. It can't possibly, as you pointed out, be because Cameron needs the money.
No.
Everything that you remember of it being brilliant, it is a phenomenally well-made film.
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger is given exactly the thing to do that he does best. We said that Adam Driver's deadpan. He's a picture of animation compared to Schwarzenegger. but that's the whole point of his character. He's
brilliant.
He does it brilliantly. And he's got a very, very tight, very concise story. There's none of the monstrous bagginess that we've come to expect. I mean, if this film were being made today, it would be 4 hours long.
Yeah,
it's barely two. It's tight. It's taut. It's very, very sharp. And it helps that the cast is small. Basically, you've got Schwarzenegger, you've got Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor, and an absolutely brilliant Edward Furlong as John Connor.
And then
you've got Robert Patrick as the T-1000, the liquid Terminator. And basically, that's it. That's what very nearly all of the story revolves around those few characters. Like I say, Edward Furlong as the young John Connor is outstanding. It's a shame he's not really gone on to do a huge amount of brilliance since then, because he was very, very good in this.
Yes.
The special effects are astonishing.
Yeah.
Especially the liquid Terminator, the T-1000, is amazing.
But
there's very little else. It's not baggy. It's not loose. It's not. There's very little extraneous stuff going on. It focuses on these characters, and it does it very, very well.
Yeah, it's a real thriller. Actually, you know, it's an action movie, but there's an element of thrill to it and tension. I recall that really, the whole thing about the Terminator chasing them is just really maintained very, very well, I think, as it was in the first film. Yeah. Anyway, so that still seems to hold up pretty well for you. What about the 3D aspect of it, though?
What 3D? No, seriously, it wasn't made in 3D. I know Cameron's the master of 3D, the action and retrofitting films into 3D, but quite frankly, they needn't have bothered. You can always tell a film was made for 3D because there's lots of things going pointy out of the screen at you.
Yes, yes.
So there's obviously none of that. There's a little bit at the beginning where you get the feeling of, rather than true 3D, there's just like flat things on layers going back and back. There's very little depth within objects. And you stop noticing it about 5 minutes in because the story is tight enough that you get enthralled by it all over again. And frankly, they should have just re-released it. Just get a nice brand new digital print, re-release it, and don't bother with the 3D. It didn't need doing. It's such a good film. It stands up on its own so well that it was unnecessary. It was just a good film.
Yeah. Actually, you know what, Steve? Even films that are made in 3D from the get-go, I often find after the initial 5 or 10 minutes, as you say, I often find my eyes adjust and I kind of forget about the 3D as the film goes on anyway. I find that tends to happen quite a lot with these films.
And I think that in that case, you wouldn't even notice that this was in 3D. It's unnecessary. Like I say, it stands alone. It really does.
Yeah. Okay. Well, probably to go and see it on the big screen again might be enough of a bait to get me there. You know, I remembered enjoying it immensely, and it would be quite good to sit down and watch the whole thing unfold on a big screen in front of me. So mainly that's a tick, really, although, as you say, the 3D thing, why bother? But 25 years on, it's just kind of an interesting exercise to see how these sort of films hold up. So very good.
And I tell you what, it holds up better than most of the current crop of action films. It really does.
Yes.
So, speaking of films that have held up well, that was a rubbish link, I apologise for that.
That's all right.
Okay, speaking of rubbish.
Okay, yes.
Stephen King adaptations.
Yes, yes, yes.
Are a mixed bag.
Yes.
I mean, when they're good, they're The Shawshank Redemption.
The Shining.
Absolutely. Stand By Me.
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, The Green Mile.
Yeah, there's been a lot of them.
Well,
is Carrie one of his stories?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And we've got It coming out next month.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're good, the Shawshank. When they're bad, Simon, tell us about the Dark Tower.
Yes, yes, indeed. So actually, we're talking about actually it was a series of novels, Steve, that he put out. I don't know the exact dates in front of me, but Stephen King, I think there were 8 of them.
Yes.
Novels called The Dark Tower. Sort of a very much a fantasy world that he created. And this is a film that has been a long time in the making. It has a couple of very well-known actors in Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey in it.
Oh, wow.
I'd love to tell you that I enjoyed it, but I can't. I can't. I just... Oh, I'd love to. I have to say to you right off the top, I have not read the books. Right. So I did go into this cold, and it left me cold. Despite, you know, McConaughey and Elba being very accomplished actors, and there's actually a pretty decent turn from a young British actor called Tom Taylor, who plays a very central character. He's about, I don't know, 12 or 13 years old, a character called Jake Chambers. Yeah. And there are pretty decent quality special effects that... Something about the way it all hangs together, something about the script, something about the way I guess they've tried to compress, you know, 8 novels into one film.
Yeah.
To me, anyway, it just almost had a B-movie quality about it. I certainly did not buy into the story or the characters, and maybe I just didn't have enough time because I'm not familiar with it to get there. Just very, very briefly, the Dark Tower of the title is a dark tower. It looks a bit like the Mordor, the tower of Tolkien's tower in the Lord of the Rings. But this is a good tower, Steve.
Oh, right.
It holds the universe together. It protects the universe from the darkness and the evil beyond.
Of course it does.
Of course it does. And in this film, we have a sorcerer who's always dressed in black, and he's called Walter.
That's a great name for a sorcerer, isn't it? It's a very, very, very sorcery name.
It is. And this is played by McConaughey.
Really?
And his... Oh, yes. And with a dyed black hair. He's black. He's the man in black. He wants to destroy the tower, let in all the monsters lurking on the borders, and apparently he just wants to take over and rule everything. Now, standing in his way were a posse of sort of magical gunslingers who protected the tower. He's killed all of them except one, and that one is a guy called Roland. Roland is played by Idris Elba.
Okay,
so that's the two forces at work here fighting each other. Into the mix, we have this young lad called Jake, who has, and this is interesting, he has a shine, very much like the shine the young lad had in the film The Shining. And he has an inner energy that Walter wants to use, this the bad guy, wants to use the young lad's shine to help destroy the tower once and for all. So he wants to get his grips on young Jake. But Jake, being a good lad, sides up with Roland, the gunslinger, and the two of them form this sort of partnership. And the film involves a game of cat and mouse between Roland and the young lad against the man in black, Walter. I'm compressing a lot there, and I think they had to compress a huge amount of material to make this film work. It's not that the actors don't do their jobs, Steve. I just thought that their lines weren't particularly inspiring. They were a little bit corny. I felt I just didn't know enough about these characters. We know that McConaughey's character is evil. I'm not quite sure why he's evil and what's behind his desire to sort of just rule everything. Elba's character, Roland, he's quite mysterious, but he kind of remains mysterious. I don't really felt I really got to know him either. And when you hear how this film took 10 years to make, it went through 3 different production companies, 3 different directors.
Oh, Lord.
It gives you an idea that perhaps there were troubled waters that needed to be negotiated through a long period of time to get this to coalesce. And in the end, anyway, it looks all right, and it's another one of those sci-fi fantasy films, but I didn't really engage with it. I didn't connect with it emotionally as I would have liked to, despite some decent actors. I just felt that the story and the script just didn't make it for me.
What more
can I tell you? I'm sorry.
I've not heard a single phrase from you there that they could put on the posters to sell this.
No, don't.
No, I mean, here's a paradox for you. You know, we mentioned all those classic Stephen King films earlier. And as far as I'm concerned, probably the two Stephen King adaptations that are held up as being like the pinnacles of, you know, the best of his films are probably Stand By Me and Shawshank Redemption. And it occurs to me one thing that those two have in common is they're both based on short stories.
Whereas
this one here, as you say, is 8 books compressed into 1.5 hours. It seems like you can't take that much material and try and compress it that tightly.
You're asking for trouble.
You're asking for trouble, and it sounds like that's that. You kept saying, "And he does this, and I don't know why." And you're thinking, "That's well, clearly that's what got jettisoned in trying to compress eight books into a single, by modern standards, very short film."
Yes, yeah. I guess the only thing I should say is, it would be interesting to hear from someone who had read the books and was familiar with the material, whether they have a different perspective and would say something different. And maybe, you know, if anyone has listening to this and would like to just chime in, just we'll give you the details how to get in touch with us here at Crave. But do let us know, and we'll mention your views next time.
If you've read the books, if you've seen the film, and you haven't yet lost the will to live, please get in touch.
Right.
I really think we should move on from that one, don't you, Simon? Because I'm not hearing a resounding endorsement from this.
Not even close.
I mean, just out of loyalty to Stephen King, should I go and see it?
No.
Okay, that was simple. It's just the tone of desperation in your voice. You can't even summon the energy to criticise it any longer. No.
Well, it's really disappointing when there are two, you know, a few actors that I like. I like Idris Elba. I quite like McConaughey. I know he's had a bit of an up and down ride, but I enjoyed their work mostly. And so that made it even more disappointing. Anyway, let's leave that. Yes.
Tell me about something good.
Well, good-ish. And this.
I'll take it, mate.
Yeah. Okay. And there's a link to The Dark Tower, actually. Now, before they became a film, those Dark Tower novels by Stephen King were actually turned into a series of graphic novels by, wait for it, Marvel Comics. Who else? And they were quite a long-running series as well. Now, on Friday, this just gone, the latest offering from Marvel appeared on Netflix.
Ooh.
Now, Steve, we've obviously spent a fair bit of time on Crave. We've chatted about all those Marvel superhero movies, and I say the movies, the cinematic releases of recent years. Yeah, there have been so many of them.
I think the phrase ad nauseum is possibly appropriate.
Yes, I think it might be the case. I talked about suffering from superhero fatigue the last time. But actually, while all that's been going on, at the same time, Marvel has been putting out a series of TV shows on Netflix. Now, the difference is that, you know, in the movies, we've been seeing these sort of high-flying, high-powered characters like Iron Man and Thor and Hulk, you know, really universe-changing characters. The TV stories have featured a different type of Marvel character, grittier, sort of street-level characters. Their powers are a little more modest than these other ones. And so far, over the last few years, they've taken four different characters and given them individual series.
Oh, okay.
So we've had a series dealing with Daredevil, mm-hmm. another character called Jessica Jones, mm-hmm. another character called Luke Cage, and another character called Daniel Rand, who's also goes by the name of Iron Fist.
Oh, not Iron Man, just Iron Fist.
No, Iron Fist.
Oh, okay.
He's a martial arts chappy. Now, do you like the word I use, chappy there? So what they've done is they've brought all these four together in a group, and they've called them the Defenders. And so, as with all these things, they release the whole series in one go. So you can sit down and, if you have Netflix, sit down and watch the whole thing from go to woe in one sitting. I haven't got that far yet, but I've watched the first two or three. I think the thing that you would say to recommend them, Steve, is while the production don't have the special effects firepower of the movies, they still have a certain dark, gritty quality to them. They're a little more adult. The language is a bit saltier. The, you know, there's, I wouldn't say it's not full of sex or anything, but they're sort of a little more adult themed. And because they're played out over many episodes, there's lots of time to get familiar with the characters. I don't think this is anywhere near like a Breaking Bad or a Mad Men or Game of Thrones. It's not that level of quality, but it's a little more, it treats you with a little more maturity than perhaps the movies are, which are really out for a sort of popcorn type audience.
Right.
And of the four characters, three of them I think are reasonably well written and drawn. But the one I don't like is the Iron Fist character, who I think the writers got him wrong and made him a bit of a petulant, unlikable, annoying chap. And I don't particularly – I'm not buying into him. But we have Sigourney Weaver in this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's playing the chief baddie. And I'm a bit of a Sigourney Weaver fan from way back from the first Alien movie, I think. And she's good. She carries it off rather well. I know you're not – your cup of tea doesn't tend to be these movies. I don't think that's your natural default, is it?
I've yet to see one that's done compelling, really.
Right. So I don't think these would change your mind, but they are a sort of lower key approach to it and a more sort of a Yeah, like a sort of a noirish, darker attempt at telling a superhero story. So in that sense, you know, you might have a wee look just to see, but I knowing, getting to know your taste as I do, I don't think it would convert you by any means, but it would just give you a different take on it, that's all. So from that point of view, it would help if you'd perhaps seen some of the earlier Netflix series. It's worth a look if you have. I will carry on and see it to the end just because I'm interested to see where they take it. But I can't sort of give a huge, huge tick. I think it's a sort of a, what do you call it, an acquired taste. There you go.
I might just give it a look then.
Just a quick look.
How essential is it to have seen the individual series, or can you watch this cold?
I think you can watch it cold, but there's a lot of reference to what's happened before. Basically, these four characters are teaming up in New York City to take on a malevolent crime syndicate with thousands of years old, with martial arts sort of pedigree, called The Hand.
Okay.
And that hand has appeared in most of the series that we've seen.
Yeah.
Of the previous series. And there are relationships between these characters that have been established in the previous series here and there. So it would be potentially a little bit confusing. Yeah, it would certainly help. I actually be interesting if you had even to watch the first episode to see whether you think it makes any sense at all or not. If you get a chance, do so, and we'll talk about it next time. Might just
do that then. So, yeah. So what I'm hearing is not so much superheroes as mediocre heroes.
Well, certainly in terms of their power set, they're not so super.
Okay.
But I think that noirish type of attempt to tell the story makes it a little bit interesting, and it might make... It might appeal to a different sort of audience, I think. That would be perhaps the issue. But it's not, it's not Breaking Bad. It's not that quality.
Well, to be fair, so very, very little is, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's, you know, I'm not giving it an absolute ringing endorsement, but it's worth a little dabble. How about that?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Now,
that's been, I mean, it's been a fairly busy week for the last couple of weeks for the two of us. We got slightly quieter time coming up. We actually get to draw breath in the next week or two, which is good. There's a couple of big openings, though, that are coming up that will speak to some people. There is a... I can't decide if I like the look of it or not. The trailers look good. It's getting bad reviews from English. Is The Hitman's Bodyguard.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the trailer. Yep.
Yeah. Trailer looks good. Reviews from Britain, where it's already opened, are worrying.
Okay.
It's Ryan Reynolds and Samuel Jackson. So
yeah.
On paper, should be brilliant. I think you'll agree.
Yes, yes.
Remains
to be seen. Okay.
And we've also got coming up is... Now, I need to get the name right on this.
Please do.
American something. American Made, that's the one, yes.
With Tom Cruise.
The new Tom Cruise vehicle.
Vehicle being the good word to use.
Well, they tend to be, don't they?
Yeah.
Which, again, has a look of being very slightly crime caper-ish. Again, the trailer looks fantastic.
Okay, so there's a few interesting movies or TV shows coming up, Steve. What about on the music scene? I've seen some interesting posters around the town.
Yeah, there's one or two quite interesting shows coming up. There's one that I don't even know we should bother even mentioning with a straight face. Are you a David Duchovny fan?
Well, I saw that. I sort of am. I mean, I know he's another kind of quirky character, isn't he? I didn't know he was a musician. I've seen the poster. I mean, I know him from X-Files, and although I didn't see it, I know he got a... that was it called Californication? Was that the other long-running series he's done?
Yes, yes. It was a weird show, that one was.
Was it? Yeah. What are his credentials in the music scene?
I honestly don't know. He has he has released an album. Now, the press release, which is about all I know of it, to be fair, says it's called Hell or High Water, that features his musings on pride, loss and remorse, and it pays homage to his musical heroes of Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Leonard Cohen and R.E.M. So in other words, it's very, very mainstream, safe, middle-of-the-road American pop rock by the sound of things. So if you're interested, and I can tell you're intrigued, Tuesday, February the 20th at the Power Station in Auckland, and then if you go down to Wellington, he's doing San Fran on the following night, February the 21st.
Right, right. Okay.
Not completely convinced that's the biggest date of the year. We've also got Marky Ramone.
Oh.
Yeah.
Of the Ramones? Okay.
The very fellow, yes. The drummer is bringing Marky Ramone's Blitzkrieg, and he's basically doing a Grace's Hits tour, pretty much. That's going to be in November, the 30th in Wellington, San Fran. He's doing December the 1st in Auckland at the studio, and then he's going back down to Christchurch on the 2nd, playing the Foundry. And again, slightly unusual one.
Yeah.
We've got, again, another blast from the past, Dweezil Zappa.
Okay.
That'll be Frank's little boy.
Righto, yes.
Celebrating 50 years of Frank is the tagline for that one. And he's going to be in Auckland on the 20th of February at the Bruce Mason Centre in Takapuna.
Okay.
We're building up here. We're building up. One that's worth mentioning. It's kind of an interesting one. The full details are on our website, cravepodcast.com. But a couple of Kiwi acts, Thea, Kieran McKeegan, Esther and Opal House, are going to be joining a lineup of 1,000 musicians playing small shows in 200 cities across 24 hours on September the 20th in support of Give a Home,
which is
an Amnesty International initiative
supporting
refugees. It's a worldwide project, this one. There's going to be Kiwis like Broods and the Naked and the Famous are going to be performing in Los Angeles. But the aforementioned will be playing in Auckland and in Wellington as part of a worldwide thing that's also including people like Ed Sheeran.
Okay. And there's another announcement, Steve. someone for an artist who would appeal to someone about my age group, and as would the supporting act. So we're talking about one very famous member of Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, that would be Stevie Nicks, wouldn't it? Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Who's going to be at the Spark Arena in Auckland on Tuesday the 21st of November, and on Friday the 24th of November, she's heading down to Forsyth Barr Stadium in Dunedin, and supporting and opening up for her is going to be the Pretenders.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of people very keen to see those two artists, I would say.
I had the privilege of seeing the Pretenders in about 1986 or 87, I think it was, opening up for U2 in Leeds.
Okay.
Certainly back in the 80s, they were fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. They were here in the 80s. I saw them at a weekend festival called Sweetwaters.
Oh, right.
That was in about 84, 85. They were very good. And, that's only about 30 years ago plus. But anyway, let's hope they've aged well.
That is always the risk, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, maybe we'll find out in November.
Next year. So there's a lot coming up to look forward to. It's fantastic.
It's a great time to be alive.
It is. So, hey, we really love chatting about all this stuff. We'd love to hear from you as well at any time. I know we get some decent likes on Facebook. Thank you very much for that. If you want to drop us a line on Facebook or anywhere else, please do so. First of all, let's start with the email address. That's easy. That's podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter @cravepodcast, imaginatively enough.
Oh, we're very clever like that. Anyway, I'm Simon Mercer.
And I'm Steve McCabe.
He is, and that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Good job.
Lovely.